Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 123, Buddhist Inner Sciences, Chakras.
So the point is that if, therefore, the Buddha was aware of all the other future potentialities of all the other beings, then to fulfill his bodhisattva vow, he had to manifest in this crazy idea that Buddhists have, that when you become this infinite, you become this conscious infinity of energy, you can manifest whatever you want out of that infinity of energy. Except your power is limited. You're not omnipotent because your power is limited in the sense that you cannot force any other being to achieve that mind instantaneously. It's, you're not a bliss bomb that blows everybody else into the blissful merger with the clear light of the void, into Buddhahood. Because why? Because in a way you do have infinite energy because there is this quiescent infinite energy according to the clear light of the void, like the Satchitananda. I think it's the same Brahman field of the Satchitananda. But, and you can, since you're one with all of it, you can shape anything you want out of it, including continuing to shape what seemed to have been something like your previous body. But your compassion, therefore, lets you know the exact sensitivity of all the beings that are in this infinity with you. And those who are, and of course there are infinite Buddhas in the same place with you, and they're fine, you don't worry about them. But the ones who are suffering there, each one needs a specific treatment. Each one needs a specific path of evolution. And the preposterous claim is, preposterous from our sort of materialist, lowly expectation type of attitudes, is that you can manifest whatever it takes to optimally bring whoever it is and whatever it is toward their own fulfillment, which will be identical to your fulfillment when they achieve it, except that it will be they personally who will be enjoying it as you are enjoying it, type of thing. That's called the Nirmanakaya. It's a body of emanation. Nirmana means to emanate something. So then you can emanate. The gods can emanate too. They can emanate whole armies full of soldiers or something like that. They do. But they're not quite limitless according to the Buddhist thing. But whereas a Buddha or a god who becomes a Buddha is limitless in their ability to do that, they claim. So, and it's in a way it kind of has to do it, because since you're one with the suffering beings, although. And then again, it's not that your sensitivity, your compassion, empathy, and sensitivity gets bogged into their suffering. It's again a little paradoxical, because you are completely aware of exactly their suffering and exactly what's causing it and exactly how they themselves have to do whatever to open it up and to open up to the actual their own reality. But at the same time, you see their own reality, so you see them in their contortion of suffering, having through ignorance, their ignorance has shaped their constitution of bliss void indivisible, which is what they really are, bliss freedom indivisible. You know, they're all July 4th beings, totally free, but so you see them simultaneously already cured, but had taking time to reach their own awareness of being cured. So then your compassion forces you to emanate into all those future crossroads, places where they have free choice and make decisions, you know, and be whatever it takes to sort of nudge them in the right directions without being able to force them to do anything. So therefore, this body, with these 24 arms and all these fingers and with 722 colleagues, which include all the gods, actually, all the known ones in India at the time, you know, poor old Yahweh is not. He's not hanging out because he doesn't know about it. You know, he's stuck in the desert. But, you know, Yahweh and a few others, you know. But the Indian ones are all there. They're totally there. And their wives are there. And so no one is on their own. Like, you know, making whatever, Shiva, like, you know, making third eye blasts. You know, remember how the gods were afraid Shiva would destroy the universe with his third eye after Parvati died? He was so upset. So they sent his reincarnation over to try to get him to calm down. Remember that? Okay. So in other words, it's the idea of time. It's different. The wonderful vision that Krishna showed in the Bhagavad Gita, where he showed Mahakala, time the destroyer, which it is, right? It's death, you know, like becomes old age and death. So he was showing, he was reassuring Arjuna that he's the one responsible for the deaths of all the soldiers and things when he's going to fight in the battle. If you remember that vision, I think in the 11th chapter. I think, I forget. Exactly. And so that's time the destroyer. But here, what time is made by compassion into the field, like the greenhouse, you know, like the fields or the flowering of the individual beings into their full evolutionary potential, which is called Buddhahood. It has nothing to do with religion or anything like that. It just has to do with this vision of evolution. It's actually a scientific proposition. But it's an amazing, I think it's an amazing symbol. So I personally really do love it. I do. And in some ways, it is said like Samaja, Chakrasambhara, and Yamantaka and things like that are more yogically something or other. This one is, but there's something really special about this one. I feel it has all of their elements in it myself. I really like that. There is a Lone Ranger form, Ekavira form, a Lone Ranger form of Kavachakra called Vajra Vega and Vajra Force, you know. So I used to tease George Lucas and say, oh, you discovered the force, did you? What do you mean? He said, well, you, I thought you found that in the Kavachakra Tantra, didn't you? He says, oh, I never heard that. Well, and then he said, force isn't really good, he said. And I said, oh, George, you know, the people who really align with the force, good ones, they're a little stronger, right? You know? And I was trying to encourage him because he was upset about the movie that was made without him. The reason why. A little upset. Did you see it? But see, what I took was I went to the moment, wasn't the beautiful moment of that movie? Was where the girl, you know, who's the granddaughter of somebody, daughter of somebody, she's much weaker than that guy, you know, that nasty look behind. You know? And yet she's holding him off like this, and then she goes in and she remembers the old lady who said, well, the force is beautiful, you know, just let it go, you know. And then suddenly she has this super strength, right? Flings him all over the place. She's the gentle one, but she has the greater strength. I was really late. I'm sorry. I try to encourage him. This is the penthouse occupants of the Kalachakra. This is called the Great Bliss Circle. And in that there, are those are the eight Shaktis, they're called, the Numas. And always in the Tantric Mandala, in the Buddhist thing, the east is always the down thing rather than the south, you know. And so the north is on the right side, the left side of the central deity. And the south is on the right side. So these are the eight Shaktis, eight-armed goddesses with the Kalachakra. And Vishwamata, the name of Mrs. Kalachakra, is Vishwamata, Universal Mother. She's like Prajna Paramita in that sense. And this one I thought you'd like to think was fun. This is a Tibetan version of our chakras. But don't worry. About it, like, I have always been to that. Because this is software, you know, not hardware. In other words, there is hardware in there, but the chakra images that you have, and I know you probably know some from Hatha Yoga developments, they are as well, which are fairly similar mostly. They have different syllables and there's some differences. But, they are ways of structuring the sensitivity in the central nervous system. And for example, Kalachakra is a little different from some of the others. The top one there is actually a little bit above your normal head. It's not inside your coarse body. It's above. If you have an Ushnisha, what is called an Ushnisha, which if you notice, Buddha has this extra, I call it the extra scoop of brain he has up there. Has an extra scoop up there, like a little tower on top of his, the crown of his head. And if you had one, that would be that chakra with four petals, four openings on there. And then the next one down is the crown chakra, which is a little different than it is in other traditions. And then the next one, the very complex one there, is the throat chakra, because of the speech thing. It's a 32-petal one, and the 16 is the one above. Well, usually the throat is 16 and the brain is 32, but this time the brain is that. Then the heart chakra is next down. That's only 8 petals. And then the 64-petal navel chakra is the next one down. And finally, there's the genital chakra, secret chakra, which is also 32 petals. And then the central channel is going there, and they somehow make a face out of it. It's interesting. And you know, as you were doing that, right? The right channel, which the Buddhists call the rasana, and the left one, which they call the lalana, which I think you guys call the idan pingala, right? And then the sushumna, the central channel, which is the avadhuti, that the Buddhists call avadhuti, goes down. And then in the normal field, that's another kind of chakra. Oh, that's more thing. We don't need that. I want to find this other thing. I'm sorry. Don't get dizzy. I want to find another thing. Oh, yeah. Well, that's nice because it sort of gives you a sense of what it feels like when you visualize. You know, if you visualize that purifying breath thing where you go in your right nostril and in your left nostril, etc., if you visualize yourself having this plumbing in there, central channel is in the middle, the purplish thing, coming out to third eye point, and then these two come out down to the two nostrils, and they go down. This one has it just going to the navel. It's just trying to show how it feels up above. And actually, it goes all the way down to the perineum and out to the tip of the genitalia, male or female. And there's another picture, medical. That's the Tibetan medicine one showing. This one doesn't have the Kala Chakra one on the top. It just has five of them, which is the more usual one. And then this is what I'm showing. This is another version of it, of the one without the Kala Chakra. This is Guhya Samaja. But you see this, where the right and left ones loop around. You see the loops on the left of this picture? And then the looping around, there's a lot of looping around there in the middle, you see? And then there's a loop around, and it doesn't really show because it's only going to the navel chakra. It's only showing four chakras. So it has to go to the genital one. But all the chakras but the heart chakra have one loop of the right one and one loop of the left one, the red one, the white one, that pinch off the openness of the central channel. So the ordinary person does not experience energy or feel energy in the central channel. Except a little bit when they pass out, when they have orgasm. Those are the only two times, because that's when the energy goes to one of the other openings of the central channel. I'm talking a very ordinary person, not necessarily the yogi. And of course at death, then everyone dies. And the reason that's looped off for the ordinary person is that then the heart one has what's called a sixfold knot, which often is what is symbolized by the double triangle interpenetrating two triangles, like the Shiva Shakti thing, is the sixfold knot. And that's very tight and very difficult to unravel, that is. And that's because that's holding the subtle life force, the super subtle body-mind, in the center of that sixfold knot, in the central channel, in like a little chamber there, between the three upper loops and the three lower loops. And here they're showing the loops as if they are loose. You see there's six loops there. You see two red ones and a white one below the center. It doesn't show the center part. And then two white ones and a red one above. And the white one is associated with the male and with semen. The red one is associated with the female and with what I call ovum. In the text, they say blood simply, and this gives, people the wrong idea that it's just blood. But it's actually the fertile part of blood that produces eggs, you know, in the ovary. So I don't know what you call that in English, actually. Did you ever find that in any of the corpses? Female corpses? Was there a name for that? Because it's not in ordinary blood, obviously, is not going to be fertile, right? So the fertility thing is some kind of subtle substance, and that's what they're talking about. And that I call it ovum, but I don't know if there is a name for it in medicine. Any doctors here know the name? So there, in semen, there's sperm, right? That's the fertile element in the semen, right? But there's what is the fertile element in special type of blood that the ovary works on? And then can be, when it doesn't work out, it gets released in menstruation. But ordinary blood goes with that too. So there's something special in the blood, that's what I'm saying. That's very important to know. Because some people who wrongly interpret Tantra, they think Tantra was some sort of giant, multi-thousand-year slurp fest of people drinking sex juices. And then they drank it, and then they felt like they flew or something, which is the biggest bunch of wrongness. I mean, really, if it was that easy. Slurp down some sex juice and then you're done, it's no problem. Most ridiculous books, but when they publish books like that and they get awards in academia, they're all, oh, I did great research. Because the sort of Western contempt for the great Indian yogi and scientists is so huge that they would imagine that these siddhas were running around looking for pussy. And that was it. Some really suppressed monks suddenly jumped out of their monasteries and ran out. Right? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Explains everything.
Huh?
Yeah, that explains everything.
Anyway, I gave a speech like that to some of the people who were friends of those writers in Norway, and they didn't burn me at the stake. Actually, they were persuaded. What?
So you're saying that it's more of the ovulation fluid?
And yeah, whatever that is.
When that's usually, you know, when the woman's most ecstatic and most fertile, and then there's often at the exact time of ovulation some blood that comes with it too.
Yeah.
So that's much more, makes a lot more sense to me than just the straight.
Yeah, they go on saying med blood, and then they think, well, I better say menstrual blood. Then they go menstrual blood, and they think everybody's trying to slurp down the menstrual blood. I mean, give me a break. Sure, there might be something interesting about that, but you know, because they're overcoming all kinds of taboos. But that's not going to make you fly. I never heard such nonsense. You know? And that's actually, God has tenure and sense of right. All those kaulas, that's what the kula is, and the kaulas, and that. And that's, oh, they're out there. I mean, really, I don't want to grow up. So silly. But I finally got that to them at the International Association of Tibetan Studies. I did.
Ovum's good translation.
What?
Ovum, good translation.
Yes, I got it. Anyway, so I thought you'd find this interesting. This is a nice medical one. And the medical one tends to be a little bit, you see the red and the white and then the looping. But they don't show like the six-fold loop and all this thing at the heart center. And the unraveling at the heart center is really, you got into it the other day, you started going off into trance about the heart. And that is, you know, Tsongkhapa makes that total point all the time. You know, that a lot of yogis and a lot of people interpret the Tantra that the way of entering the central channel is, you know, after you've done a lot of things and you loosen up the knots, you know, is to go in and because it's related to orgasm, so you go in through the center of the genital chakra. You go in, go back in and orgasm internally in the petals of the different chakras, and so you orgasm all the way chakra by chakra, you know. And that's all great. Buddha, he says, that's all good stuff. No problem, it's a big deal and it's great. But the ultimate thing is not when it goes there or when it goes in the brain. The ultimate thing is when it happens in the heart, and where you can open completely the heart chakra, which everybody has done that millions of times, according to them, according to their science. Every time you have died in all of your previous lives, you completely open your central channel. When you open the heart chakra, it's when that your subtle body mind leaves town, takes off, and that's why they do that thing where they try to make it go up. Because that's a little, goes into a better direction if it goes up than down. But the highest siddha yogi is who opens that and then can stay, keep it there, or can leave the body suspended in clear light, infinite energy, in what they call from outside a cataleptic trance, you know, where they're not even breathing, actually, but somehow the oxygen is getting to where it needs to go enough to maintain life, like hibernating, you know, like life support, you know. And then from that central place, they leave, and they go into this what's called the magic body, which is like a bardo body, and then they go around and do things and accumulate merit and cleanse the deep unconscious and purify the super subtle, the DNA of the soul type of thing. Really, really, really exalted, far out thing. And what my proof in Norway to those people was, one of them, is that in order to do that, if you have a partner who's just someone off the street, who doesn't know anything and just is into having ordinary sexuality, for whatever reason, either coerced or hired or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, then they're not going to want to sit still and have orgasms up inside their central channel, because their central channel isn't open. So they're going to start the normal huffing and puffing routine that we don't know about. And then this person is going to be just, you know, not able to do their trick. You know what I'm saying? Opening the heart chakra and all this complex thing. When the body, when actually they're going to abandon the coarse body. Then further one, I get a little more. I'm sorry, I'm telling you, but you're a yogi. The further one that really surprised them and surprised me when I started thinking about it is something called the nine mergers for a yogi who begins to have opened the channel and start to do these magic body things. And one of them has to do with coming back and merging the magic body back into their own central channel and coming back into their previous coarse body as a yogi, as an ordinary human. And as to be a siddha, you know, to help people in their society, you know, which is not necessarily something that they feel like doing because they're in a more blissful, subtle body condition. But there's a yoga, one of the mergers is where you come back and you merge the emanation body that you've been experimenting with, the Buddha and Buddha body, the Sambhoga body of a Buddha, and the Dharma, the reality body of a Buddha, and you merge them back into your you know, sleep state, dream state, waking state, come back and be yourself. But when you do that, this is an interesting mechanism. We were talking about this, about rebirth. When you do that, you see yourself and your consort, your former body and your consort, as parents, as a set of parents. And then you go down and you enter your own mouth or crown. You know, because you're coming like a bardo, you're like a bardo being in the magic body. You know, like, but you're in a great samaja body or a kalachakra body or whatever, which you've learned to do from long, massive periods of mental stabilization, where you really can re-envision yourself in some land, feel your shoulder having three arms on each side, or 24 or 12 on each side, whatever it is. And you come back in, you leave that, you melt into the clear light, and then you come back in into your own mouth, crown, down through your own central channel, into the womb of the consort, and then at that point, coming from the consort, you then re-enter your own heart chakra somehow. I mean, I don't quite know how that part works, where the link up is, not sure. But you're in this complete embrace with that consort. So in other words, they become your mother and father. Because you may not know that, those of you who haven't read the Tibetan misnamed Book of the Dead, which is actually called the Book of Natural Liberation in the Between State, it has nothing to do with any dead. But the mechanism of taking rebirth is where you are attracted to your parents. You have a primal scene with your parents before conception. You know what primal scene is? The psychologists know that, right? You don't know the primal scene? Oh, primal scene. Freud had all these poor women in these different sales islands who were freaking out, and then he got back with them to the primal scene, which was where they wandered in little like, you know, Isabella or something, wandered into the bedroom where mom and dad were into huffing and puffing. And then she's freaking out, you know. And then he said, because she wants to... But he didn't know about this. It was already thousands of years, India and Tibet, they were aware of this kind of a thing. And instead of freaking out and running out and getting hysterical and being treated by Mr. Freud, instead you get conceived. Because you get into like a gangbang with your parents. Sorry. To put it but artsy. And if you're going to be female, you really like dad. And you're kind of mom, it's like, you know, you can move over, honey. And if you're going to be male, you like mom. And dad, you could take a hike. But then what happens is you pass out. And somehow, you know, somebody pointed out, well, what if mom and dad don't even have really good sex? Well, you find it in their cells they're having good sex, even though they personally maybe have like some dysfunction. Their cells are blissfully attracted to each other, and so they're sort of open. They're in that open, near the clear light space. And naturally, therefore, they get an immigrant. The boundary's down for immigrants. And the migrant arrives. You know? So we're all migrants in that sense. So that's already there in the popular culture, in some sectors of India and in Tibet universally, by this time, by the time Buddhism has become permeated Indian, you know, Tibetan culture from India. But so then this is sort of that on the highest level, consciously doing all of that. Now, as I said, I say to them, this might be one like fantabulous delusion, and it may be totally impossible, all this. And the materialists may be right, maybe we're just really nothing, and it's just something they really work themselves into a frenzy over in India and Tibet. But to me, it makes really good sense, actually. The more I study it, the more amazing it is that people have these abilities, and as like scientists, astronauts, that's what I call them, psychonauts. They really, really did this stuff. And this is the way the world works, I believe. And it's really neat, actually, I think. Really cool. And yogis, so yogis, what are you guys doing? You know, you are, you know beyond just, you know, being healthy and being positive and being happy and, you know, releasing your inner organs and your heart and your energies and avoiding arthritis and many things that you're doing, you are also in the tradition of this thing where you are seeing your own body as a vehicle of holy happiness and deep inner bliss. And to satisfy yourself in life without having to, like, you know, go bankrupt and kill all your suppliers and become Donald Trump and a billionaire, you're going to be blissful without grabbing all these things that are not going to really... I don't think Donald Trump has fun.
No.
Not really. He likes shouting and screaming, but he's terrible. Look at his face. He doesn't feel that. He doesn't. He has the emotional plague, what Wilhelm Reich called. The only Western psychologist who really got close to this deep inner energy level that these people have discovered and that you are working on with your great teacher on this is Wilhelm Reich. If anybody that never heard of him or doesn't know who that is, I advise you to take a look at it. And he has this great expression called the emotional plague, which afflicts any society that he knew, which were Western societies, but actually does afflict Asian ones as well. And it has to do with a kind of a desensitization of the human being and an infliction of a culture through posture, actually, and structure of the way the body is held. And he gives a brilliant analysis of the militaristic posture, where the chin is jammed down in the throat and the stomach is sucked in to imprison the diaphragm, where you won't feel inner fear or any kind of sensitivity or streaming. The pelvis is retracted, so your butt is sticking out, right, like this, you know, and pelvis drawn back. And so basically you're meant to be made by posture unfeeling as possible. And therefore, you become a very frustrated being, and you can't feel your inner, what he called, streaming, your inner orgone energy, which means just natural energy, natural bliss energy. You can't feel it. And he had blue light. It was had blue color. He somehow discovered. But now he never heard of it. Well, they sit in Germany in 1910 when they heard a little of yoga, but very little. They didn't know much. And he said, and then people who are not in the military, but they all have this kind of thing. You know, women were put in these terrible corsets, you know, in Europe. Because Europe was highly militaristic, you know. Most militaristic part of Eurasia, probably. You know, and they were, what did they, you know, they would, the servants would put their foot on their back and pull this thing, like a crunch in the, and thing. And You know, ballet, which they think is so great. But you know what ballet was? Louis XIV thought that women should have a chance to prance around like the fencers, you know, killing each other with swords, but he didn't think it was appropriate to stick them in the breast with this, with the épée. So he had them do ballet like it was just a, it was a knockoff from fencing. Did you know that? I guess they're doing that. So they're doing it like this because they can't fence and savaging their toes. Of course, they can make something beautiful out of anything, and they do. I'm not totally against it, but I don't like it because I get involved in the pain of their lower legs when I go to it. I can't help myself. You can bring half a foot around if I can't enjoy too much. Anyway, so this is that. This is the kind of scientific thing. And this is the schema here. You see, coarse body mind, elemental flesh and blood. That's the meat space stuff. And the six senses are the coarse mind. You know, the six consciousnesses, mental consciousness and the five sense consciousnesses. Then the subtle body mind is the neural channels, you know, nadi, vayu, and bindu. You know, the neural channels, energies, and neurotransmitters. And of course, that female ovum, as I call it, is a bindu. You know, it's not an ordinary blood, it's a red bindu. And actually, they call it bodhicitta, bodhisattva mind, bodhisattva spirit. They actually align it with the red and white bodhisattva spirit, they call it. And and why do they do that? Because what is the bodhisattva spirit? Bodhisattva spirit is the spirit of love and compassion for all beings. Okay? So, those subtle hormones or whatever they are, I don't know, what do you call them, neurotransmitters? You know, is sperm a neurotransmitter? No. I don't know what it is. But those things, when they activate and they get into the center of the nervous system, people melt. It's a time when people melt down. And when they melt, they get close to the infinity of energy that's available for all living things. And that infinity of energy, being an infinity of energy, it has the ability to satisfy whatever need any living thing actually has, instead of this little piece of dung that the dung beetle wants to eat. Instead of eating some dung and then being hungry when you go and find some more dung, it just floats into clear light and every appetite is satisfied. And so that's when beings melt. And at that boundary of the melting is where then, of course, the migrants arrive. People who want to join in the happy party. It's a family. And then the people are there, and the mother and father are not capable in that kind of moment of thinking, this will cost me $260,000 in Harvard. I don't think I can manage this. At that moment, they might think that later. So anyway, whatever it is, that I call it neurotransmitter at this moment. And then that's the body. It's your. So actually, I love it because that's like, remember in Don Gennaro and Don Juan in Castaneda, they called boys, he saw them as a balls of luminous fibers. Remember that? So he saw their subtle body, that particular subtle body mind, their network of nadis filled with bliss energies. They're the luminous fibers. You know? Remember he saw them like them? I don't think he could have made that up, Castaneda. I think those guys really do that. And then the subtle mind are these three states called, which I call luminance, radiance, aloka, abhasa, and upalabdhi. Actually, well, aloka, aloka, abhasa, aloka, upalabdhi, these are called. So these are the luminance, radiance, immanence, intuitions. And they are, if you're more conscious of your instincts, and this one has 33 desire-related instincts in it. And this has 40 aggression-related instincts in it. This is solar, this is lunar, and this has 7 ignorance-related, you know, stupefaction, unconsciousness-related instincts. And the normal person, when they die, they go through those three states, a moonlit space, a sunlit space, a darklit space, and then, but they are surging with the instincts are taking over, they're swimming in those instincts. And then they're having like nightmares or sometimes, pleasant things, but they're very unstably swooshing around with them. And then they go unconscious in this one, in the immanence level. And then they don't recognize the clear light when they hit it. Because the clear light is like a split second of infinite expansion. But they're so desperate to be a boundary and to be able to fend off what they fear in the universe that they just rush right through that and seek for another way of being boundaried and being a person, like taking care of themselves in an environment. You know what I mean? So then that's when you hit the super subtle body mind, which is the super subtle physical energies, which are kind of pranas, but a super subtle type of prana. And sort of right on the edge, because it's this infinite thing, it's impossible to describe, even they even say it. And then clear light, this void mind. And that's a major reason that all this was esoteric in Buddhist history, because that super subtle body mind would have been attached to someone, and that's my fixed and permanent self. That little thing, you know. And I'm thinking that's a little thing that's their core thing, you know. Rather than thought that that's like everything, you know. At the same time, it's a beyond all dualities of that type. Okay? You got that? And then I have a list of the different things. But never mind. And this is where Buddha taught Tantra as a Theravada. Because these are the four, I mentioned this earlier, these are the eight states. Well, the eight states of meditative trance states, or, you know, absorption states, people like to say. I don't like that word, but I prefer trance, you know, which are, these are the former realm, and this is Brahma's realm here, equanimity level. And all of the lower states are, the higher state encompasses all the lower states, even though they seem to be separate. The lower states have not yet reached the higher states. Down here is where we are, normally, along with all other kinds of beings, including the gods of the desire realm. But these eight states are exactly the same. If you turn it upside down, I do have a slide like that, but I don't know quite where it is. Then this is like earth, water, fire, wind. And here's where you go beyond hardness, beyond solidity, beyond mass. And this is just space, consciousness, nothingness, and then that's Turiya, that's the fourth state. And none of them are nirvana, but this one is very close to a clear light of the And we talked about that the other day. Okay, that's enough for me. I think. Yes.
What?
Just to make it down to earth, you know, when you do this, if I could just supplement the breathing thing, if you visualize yourself as having a blue channel down the center, and you, usually when you do it as an initial practice, you have it at that point that Richard points to, so artistically, like that, you know, it's like four fingers below the navel, right? The hara kind of level, the pelvic floor, et cetera, right? Mula bandha, whatever. And you go there, and then you think, like plumbing pipes, and you think that the red one on the right, going from the right nostril, goes down there, and down there, and it's like one of those long, skinny balloons that Jeff Koons makes a fortune by tying into dogs. And you know those kind of balloons? And you sort of think of it as having been linked around the center, but the kinks pop out, and it becomes like a balloon. And then, like a plumbing pipe, it fits into the one on the left, if you do the right one first, it fits into the one on the left, which is white. It's red, and it fits into the red one. And then, so when you breathe in, blocking this nostril into this one, and then it goes down there, and then you hold it for a minute, and you let it sort of pop out the kinks in the balloon, you know? You think, you visualize it's doing that, and free the central channel, the blue one. And then when you blow out the right, left nostril, you feel it's coming up through the red one, through the white one, I'm sorry, and it's knocking the kinks out of the white one. And then you do it the other way, where you put the white one, and you hold it, and then you push it back up the left one. You do that three times on each side, or either alternating, or three at one, three at the other. And then you change the plumbing at the bottom, and you take the white one, the red one and the white one, and you loop them around like a plumbing juncture, where they go into the bottom of the central one, which you then imagine just being at the navel place there. You don't get involved in the genitalia, the secret place. You just put it into the central channel. So then when you breathe in both, it goes in and out, in and down the right one, you hold it for a sec while they kind of loosen up. And then when you exhale, you visualize that it's coming up the central channel and then comes out, but comes out either through the nostrils or the mouth. because it's cleared up the energy of the central channel. And you do that three times, right? So that's really nice to combine them if you do that visualization. It's considered auspicious. It isn't that when you visualize removing the threefold knot, you're going to have immediately an internal orgasm and you're going to die, because you actually can't unloosen that knot that fast or easily. But by imagining it, it establishes a subliminal basic template for somehow you eventually to do that as a yogi. Yeah. So it's nice to do even as a beginner. Is that all right? I'm sorry, I don't mean to really get into your province there, but it's kind of fun, isn't it? Well, that's a yogi thing. I'm not a yogi. Here you are.
But I think, like, when you visualize, like, knots being on, you're kind of almost feeling, you get like a little teeny taste of it.
I think so, yeah.
And then you have to go out and kind of make peace with the world. Because all those little blockages have to do with usually others, other beings. You know, that you've got some unfinished business with, you know, that you might.
That certainly must be the case. But also, it's from our culture and everything, too.
Oh, yeah, from the culture. And so you have to, like, work from inside and outside to get the knots out. And,
that's good, going back to yama and niyama.
Yeah, inside, outside. And then sometimes if you concentrate, you know, just you do a lot of this chakra vedana, piercing the chakras, nadi shodhana, blowing up, then if you haven't really, don't have the background for that, then you can go nuts.
Definitely. I've met a few.
Because of the, just because of the nature of your environment. And you still don't, you know, you still can't see your environment for how beautiful it actually is. And it's like, and you're too sensitive. Sensitivity gets to you.
Internally also, there's a thing that the Tibetan medicine calls soglum, which means sok is prana, you know, and lum is vayu, and it means, but in the medical sense, it means where, for some reason, which yogi, it can happen to yogis, where they get into dealing with the heart chakra thing, which is very well known in Tibetan culture, sort of broad level people who are not necessarily that good yogi, that good at yoga. But for some reason, they sort of put a lot of pressure on, like, forcefully, like, removing knots or something like that. You know? And then what can happen is that there can be sort of neural bubbles in the ganglion, where the knot is there, but then there's some kind of bubble there. And then that bubble can be really cause a lot of looniness. It can cause psychosis and things. And it's really a problem. And also pain. People can get, like, shooting pains and things. And they say when one gets that pain, that one has to focus on the heart chakra as the super, super subtle mind, clear light of bliss in the heart chakra, that deepest soul place, and realize that that is a gateway to infinity. And then think of a light ray coming from that in the form of a hook, like a tractor beam, like Star Trek tractor beam, and pulling back that pain, or pulling it back that bubble, pulling the prana out of that place, back into where they can go, it can be completely released in the center of the chakra. It's a nice thing they talk about as a way of doing it when you have this kind of a pain. You know, I can't really do it, but it's, I think it's really a nice thing.
Says also you have to have a guru.
John, what?
The Hatha Yoga Pradipika says you have to have a guru to pierce the knots.
Yes. Well, it's good to have a guru to do that. But you have to do it yourself. So the guru opens the door for you. And also, there's the issue of morphic resonance. It's a big issue of morphic resonance. What you really need from a guru is morphic resonance, which is just symbolized in a ritual. But the resonance, in other words, if the guru themselves has some sort of an open point in the chakra, as in, is Beda not the right word? It's name. Baba, native Baba, like fall to the marma, you know, to the marma, but I can't think. Is it was marma vedana? Is it veda? Penetrate? Might penetrate the marma. Marma meaning this sort of vital point, right? So if a guru has their vital point open, then being in the field of the guru, your vital point tends to sort of slip a little loose. That's why some people get annoyed immediately they meet guru sometimes, some kind of people. The field of the guru is a big deal. And for example, there's a wonderful thing in the ethics, actually. A wonderful thing. In the beginning of the Theravada Vinaya, the ethical thing, the monk, there's a story of a Brahmin who comes to see the Buddha against the advice of the other Brahmins, who say, don't go see that Gautama. He's like some upstart. He's like, he doesn't follow things, and he's like, whatever, I said, no, I hear he's a really great guy. I want to go and talk to him. So then he goes to see him. And then Buddha was welcome, and then he sits down next to Buddha. And he says, I heard you were really kind of cool, like wise man, really great. But, you didn't stand up when I came here, and I'm older than you. And I'm a Brahmin. And so I guess you just don't have any taste. And then the Buddha says, yeah, you're right, I don't have any taste. I only lost my taste for pleasant sounds, pleasant sights, pleasant pleasant food, pleasant taste, pleasant touch. So in a sense, it's true, you're speaking of me, you could say I have no taste. The guy says, oh, I get that, but you have no ethics, You have no etiquette, you have no manner. One after another, he keeps insulting the Buddha, because the Buddha didn't get up when he came, and just said, welcome, have a seat. And this really afflicted this Brahmin, and he can't deal with this, with what happened, But he's sort of held because he wanted to see the Buddha, and he has a feeling maybe he's a good person, but now he keeps saying, you have no brain, no manners, no this and that. The Buddha keeps agreeing, but then explains it in terms of that he's in another world. And then finally, the guy says, oh, I get it. And then he says, it's like the chicken and the egg. He says, there's several chicks and eggs in the nest. And then one chick bounds on the shell and breaks it and gets out. And then another chicken is still in there, a little chicken, and it doesn't get out yet. And then it does get out. But which one is older? Oh, the one who breaks the egg. Oh, yeah, well, I broke the egg, that's what I said. I didn't break it yet. So I said, I'm older. And then he starts, and then the guy gets a little bit convinced and says, well, what is it that you do? I mean, what's going on? The guy now he's kind of can cope with his disorientation. But then the Buddha gives this beautiful thing of all the levels of samadhi, all the ethics and all the good behavior and all the well-being and all the niceness around in society. And then finally, right after nirvana, he goes, it's the most marvelous passage, But it shows this, and then he uses that Vedic thing that's in the Vedas, actually. And at one point he says, so-and-so, elder so-and-so. The thing is, I could feel that you wanted me to get up, said. And I would have gotten up, but if a Buddha would get up, in the case of a person, then that person's head would split in seven pieces, which is a Vedic expression for someone who has some kind of a falling out, or can't make an argument or something, get something really wrong. Their head splits in seven pieces. Meaning that you would feel... No, from what your question was, you would feel the morphic resonance of someone with this total open chakra, it's like a streaming flood of bliss person. And you would feel that, and you just feel so disoriented and threatened, and you'd think, what was happening to me? I'm fainting, and you'd have a fit. Because that's, Wilhelm Reich brilliantly puts it. He says that Christ is murdered, or, siddhas are persecuted because when armored people who carry the emotional plague of insensitivity because they're not open to their own inner sensations, they're frightened of them, when they are in the field of a person with those kind of energies, streaming energies, he calls it, they start to feel them in themselves. And then that frightens them. They feel they're going to lose control, they're going to pee in their pants, they're going to go berserk, they're going to go crazy, whatever it is they feel. And so they rush to shut it off, the source of this threat, which is that energy in that other person. So they want to kill the siddha, or they want to kill the saint, or kill the the son of God, or whatever, son of man, or whatever he was. It's really interesting. So it shows that right in the Vinaya. So in a way, therefore, They have this saying, like, why isn't there a full Buddha running around? Why isn't there one in Times Square with the egg and everything, like the E.T. kind of character, like wet fingers and light with a big egg on top of his head and floating around, you know, doing miracles? Why isn't it? Because if that streaming field was open with the Trump followers, which according to Senator Bill Bradley are about 20%, 18 to 20% of the American electorate, they would be so freaked out by that energy, they'd like start doing mass shootings, and you know, you'd have riots. It would be great. So there's a kind of thing about how much do you release. There's a connectedness to the outsiders, which you rightly pointed out about. Right? From the inner to the outer. But that's on the other hand, that's a very encouraging thing, because that means if you do intense meditating yourselves, and you know someone telling you, why are you meditating all the time? You could be helping me planting the peas in the garden, or you could be washing the dishes, or whatever it is. And you could, and that's when you should, of course. But when you have a breakthrough in your mind, this resonates immediately to other people. And you know, your heart feels a little better, and then there, when they meet you, then they feel a little lift in their heart. And without you doing anything or saying anything, they certainly don't ever say, hey, how's the heart lifting? My heart's just so great. They'll be mad. But if just your own, in other words, what you're doing internally is affecting the world right away before you've done anything else. Right? So that's why you could do a retreat or something without feeling bad.
I think like the culture of, you know, the monks, monasteries, the etiquette amongst sadhus is that they generally present themselves as beggars and servants,
right,
rather than as, oh, I'm a master, you know,
right,
kiss my, you know.
I know. Cases they do the other though.
Yeah.
You know the Naropa story. Naropa was. It was into like whatever, and he had his consort, and he were into it. And somehow they couldn't get uncoupled, but they were hungry. So he was out with a bow and arrow, and she was still wrapped around him in Benares, and he was out hunting the royal deer that was sacred. And then he cooked one, and they were having a barbecue, still wrapped around him. And then the people are like, this won't do. And they say, what's the matter? Look, I just had it. And then he makes the deer come back to life and it runs off. She says, I didn't kill anything. He's like, oh, what are you doing? No. And then they put them on a big pyre and burn them at the stake. And they do. They light it. And then the next morning they come back and there's a big lotus and they're still at it. It's a little more Indian than the cross one. But it's like they're more focused on the resurrection. Sorry, guys.
That's right.
It is Independence Day. It was around a little bit. Now, Rick, that is the story of Narva. Normally, they're very long people. Sit up times. They're like anthropologists that sit up. Yeah. They go out with the tribals and they deal with people who...
They try to fit in, you know, so that they can...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. There are a few synods.
Bye.
What?
I think with,
yes, John.
Was Lucas trying to point out like the Vedanta point of view where there's the force...
Yes.
Is neither a positive thing. We tend to attribute God as this positive sort of thing. Like in the Uvashishta, he goes through this great diatribe of how,
yes,
how you know, Brahman is not positive, like, you know, this positive force that we tend to. Maybe the force is just this.
Well, you were saying the force is not positive?
Yeah, it's not a positive nor a negative. It's
just, oh. Just well. I don't know. I think that there's a saying like that, but I don't completely. I think it's more complex than that. It's like enlightenment, okay? Itself. We think that when is it that we feel relief in our normal life? other than when we have some yogic moment of attainment, but otherwise, when is it that we feel sleep? When we're unconscious and asleep, right? So, yes, when you definitely feel relief when you sleep and you're unconscious, you're happy as a bee. Come on. You're happy. If you have a bad dream and wake up, then you're unhappy. You're definitely happy. And so we naturally assume that enlightenment is going to be some sort of collapse of consciousness in some fixed state where we won't be bothered. There's a tendency to project that's what enlightenment is. But if enlightenment actually is being present infinitely in everything, and seeing beings suffering, feeling and being one with them, and being empathetic with them, and yet not being sucked into their suffering, but seeing them simultaneously in a double vision, where you see them as made of bliss, as drops in an ocean of bliss, and they are managing to suffer anyway. And so your job is, you know, joining the job of all Buddhas, all enlightened beings, and trying to help them find their own nature, which is bliss. So that's a complicated consciousness. It's maintaining kind of a cognitive dissonance to such an extreme degree it's almost inconceivable to us. You know, but rather than something. And so the beyond good and evil thing is like people who want to sort of drop out and say, well, it's all the same, really. Evil is other people suffering, but it's not, never mind. But the point is infinite energy, if that's the deepest layer of the universe rather than nothingness, if clear light of the void is such that another is the deepest layer, then it doesn't tolerate unhappiness. So therefore, it won't tolerate, it considers people suffering to be evil. And it doesn't think that, but it just automatically flows into whatever the deficit is that causes the suffering. It automatically does. Its problem with, if a being has like a notion of its boundary, it's not going to be open to receiving that grace, you know, that bliss, that sustenance. So it's going to, in fact, if it comes on too powerfully, it's going to make it more uptight. It's like rushing up to give a hug to a paranoiac. They think you're like, you know, going to give them a body slam, you know, and they fight you off. You know, so I think the Buddhists would say that the Vajra is Samantabhadra, you know, is all around goodness. That's the vision they have. Maybe they're deluded, and beyond good and evil, they don't do it. Sometimes they will say,
but that's just in relative.
What?
That's relative terms, right?
What? Well, all terms are relative. Right. All terms are relative. But relatively speaking, it is a bit Buddha's good news. I mean, Buddha was a happy camper, don't you think? Didn't he look happy? How could he be happy with people having holocausts? Unless he's like some kind of moron. He's happy because finally the goodness is there, and the insanity and the torture and the mutual destruction and the self-destruction finally wears itself out, and there's this infinite energy to supplement the deficit. So the Vajra becomes a symbol, instead of a symbol of a weapon of Indra, a weapon of an authoritarian king of the gods, the Vajra becomes a symbol of the infinite energy of the clear light of the void, which means love, pure love. Not a person, just impersonal love. If love is the wish to, as it's defined, not sexual love necessarily, but love maitri, the love of a friend, the love of a mother, if it's defined as the will to the happiness of what you're loving, beloved, then that means it's pure will to satisfaction of every being in its field, and since its field is infinite, and has infinite energy, no lack of resource, you have to call it love. In relative terms. Just fire, you know. I think, really. But it makes people sick if they overdo it. You can hate hate. That's the only thing worthy of hate. It's hate. Hate hate.
Krota yoga.
Yes.
What? Is that Krota?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, there's Krota.
Yeah, Krota, yeah. But that's why I never call it wrathful. I think that's a really bad translation. Peaceful and wrathful babies, I'd never do it. They're mild and fierce babies, or gentle and fierce babies. Fierce, like a mother, like your mom, when John Bultmann Jr. was rushing over with a joyous look on his face to stick his finger in the electric socket your mom went, don't do that,
yeah,
in a fierce manner. She was not angry with you, but she scared you. And you got, ooh. And then you developed a complex about an electric socket. Years later,
still worked
out. Right? So that's fit there, those krodas. The kroda, there's a big kroda right here. That's the all good Heruka, you know, who is trying to help you at a place when you reach a place in the Bardo where you are filled with fear and you're perceiving all kind of monsters coming at you and frightened. And they're showing, they're sort of being your protector, coming fiercer than anything that's terrifying. You know? And, but before you go there, these are the mild ones, the gentle ones over there, who are, you know, offering you sort of beauty and relaxed, you know, and love in a sort of obvious way. But these are just as loving. So they're not wrathful.
Bob, can I ask you a question about pranayama in different Buddhist traditions?
I don't think it's different.
Oh, no.
I think it's different. Different people don't know what to do.
So here's what I was going to ask. I live in Thailand.
No, you're not was going to. You are asking.
Right. I live in Thailand, and I don't really... It doesn't... Pranayama doesn't seem to be a part of the Buddhist tradition.
Of course it is. It's one of the six branches of, you know, of the perfection stages. Pranayama, pratyahara, pranayama, dharana, anusmriti, samadhi, and there's another one which I've dropped.
So something like alternate nastro breathing.
What?
Something like you were showing Nadi Shodhana, that's alternate nastro
breathing.
Is that a technique that is used equally in different Buddhist traditions?
Sure.
Okay.
But those are considered, you know, yogis, advanced thing. You know? Mm-hmm. Remember that all of the Asian traditions until recently were in cultures that were largely agricultural, but they had big cities where their people were learning, and in those cities they learned, but the masses of people, like even still in India today, are still, what, 90% is still in villages.
Still not. Yeah.
Right? And so you didn't have necessarily that many yogis in those lists. They came back from the university, Takshashila or Nalanda or somewhere, and then went to their Geburtsdorf, you know, their birth village, and were the local yogi there. And then people liked that in the village. But so it was not this... You know, it's not like today, when we either are doomed as a species on this planet, soon, or it's like Dharma everywhere, yoga everywhere, on TV, on Facebook, you know, Buddha on Facebook, Mahayogis on Facebook. It's like unprecedented. You know, and Kali Yuga Babas don't like it. They're more into the doom thing. But the Shambhala Babas think that that's where we are, opposed to. You know, where so many people are going to be like aware of that. But it's amazing here. It's considered. What?
It's happening.
It has happened. But there's some places shut off to it. And that's where all this violence and terrible stuff is going on. And that also one of the key factors of that, of course, is the women. You know? If enlightenment is not defined as some guy shooting off into outer space where he wouldn't have to wash the dishes ever, right, or be reborn as anything, then just like hanging with Brahma, meaning waiting for, you know, either having permanent food of samadhi or waiting for dinner, you know, like the Brahman does, you know, from those ladies some scuttling out of the smoky kitchen in the back, drink. And if that's not enlightenment, as some kind of ultimate narcissistic samadhi. And enlightenment is actually fusion with all life, with all beings, and super interconnection, the absolute Brahman as everywhere, everything, eye in the eye, ear in the ear, nose in the nose, hand in the dishwashing pot. Also, they didn't mention, but that too. And if that's the case, then actually the women are more advanced than the men, because toward it, as humans, because they have the visceral experience of the crossing the boundary between self and other differently than you know, much more viscerally. Viscerally is the word for it. Which man is going to have a migrant in their belly for 9 months without complaining overly. Which male is going to do that? I'd like to know. And then have labor pains. Even being in the room, you want to have a spinal block or even talk about more president. So that's a different thing. That's more complicated. Even enlightenment remains totally interconnected. They go, Buddha's free of the samsara. Yeah, sure. Sure. But actually, no. Until everyone else is not free. Even. They don't want to say it like that. It sounds rude. Poor guy. I mean, they say a Buddha is a fine thing. You read any of his books. As a mother, he perceives every sentient being as a mother perceives her only beloved child. What a nightmare. Donald Trump, my baby. Hitler. Oh. Some venomous serpent or some horrible tick. Bringing U.S. government certified germ warfare Lyme disease. I'm sorry. Happy 4th of July.
Interdependence Day.
What's that?
Interdependence Day.
Interdependence Day. If only. It should be, it will be.